is Rhode Island's longest running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to another lovely Tuesday. Well, we welcome you to another Tuesday, you know, here on the Wampanoag Trail. I'm here with my daughter, Donna Soa Allard. She's a certified financial planner professional, as am I. And on Tuesdays, what do?
We get back to basics.
We get back to basics, yeah. And the premise of Get Back to Basics, for those of you who are new to this program, is not new. Actually, it was one of the earlier weekly programs that we offered back in 1991 and 92, the beginning of the Money Talk program 26 years ago. And the understanding of it, and actually it was recommended to me by someone else who said, you know, Donald, the risk that you take being a commentator on issues of money and finance is that you don't always have a solid sense of who's listening. And if what you have to try to do is create a balance between information that you're providing that is educational, that will help your listeners better understand some of the things that are happening around them, some of the things that they will need to know in the form of education as they're asked to make decisions about things like these brand new things called 401k plans or these brand, and in those days, believe it or not, what is an IRA really? I mean, how does it work? It was interesting how people would use the term IRA and use it improperly. In other words, not knowing exactly what it was.
People still do. People still don't have and not everyone, but there are still people who don't necessarily have a sense of, you know, what a savings vehicle is and what kind of products can be used within a savings vehicle. You know, what the difference
is. The most common place I found for misunderstanding, Donna, has been the word mutual fund. The word mutual fund, I think there are a lot of people who simply think it's a stock. It may mm-hmm. be some sort of a stock. They don't understand that it's a basket that could hold just about any financial product that's out there, including precious metals, gold, silver. You know, there are mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, they call them. It's a type of mutual fund that trades like a stock, and the rules that relate to them are different. The way in which investors use them can be different. The way you pay for them certainly can be different. But the way that professionals like ourselves use various types of mutual funds and other investment vehicles is different, but it's unique to the client that we're trying to serve.
You know, not long ago, very short while ago, we replaced the phone system in our office. And when the guys came in to train us on the new system, you know, some stuff is very basic. And then other things are very basic to the people who are training us, but we have no idea what they're talking about because I don't install phone systems every day, and I don't program phone systems. And so the guy's talking to us, and he's using all of this proprietary language, you know, lingo that is just normal to him, but it's stuff that I have no idea what he's talking about. Maybe if I installed voice over IP phone systems all the time, it would be normal to me. But I had to stop him, and I said, wait a minute. I'm so sorry, but I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm trying to follow you, but you're using language that we don't use. So if you could just break this down into, you know, the basic language terms that I'm going to understand, I'd really appreciate it. And it's the same. That's our job here. And I think that's part of why, you know, this radio show has been on for so long is because you and also Stephen have always been so good at not trying to impress listeners with your vast trove of knowledge, but to explain things in terms that everybody can understand, because shockingly, everybody doesn't talk about financial terms all day long, and everybody's not an expert, right? So you have to break it down into what people can understand.
Well, even starting out the program, when we go and sort of do a market report, say, what happened today in the world of money and finance, and why, and how does what's going on in Washington, D.C., how does that affect the world of money and finance? And all of a sudden you realize you're using terms that, like, if I'm driving in the car and I'm listening to Sirius Radio, I may be listening to CNN or POTUS or MSNBC or any of these channels that are on there that are talking about politics and unique elements related to the Congress and the White House and the judiciary and all of these things all day, and they use it the same way. And then if I come in and try to use a combination of political terms to explain financial events that are occurring in the market and how geopolitical issues are affecting the stock market, I run the risk of having multiple elements of jargon, which the listener will go, what on earth did you just say? And does it matter?
And so that's the point of Get Back to Basics, right? Get rid of the jargon and just explain things in normal language that you don't have to be a financial expert to understand, right?
And some of what we'll be talking about during one of the segments of tonight's show falls smack dab into this category because, as you know, the president spent upwards of 17 days working on and trying to negotiate deals related to the American Health Care Act to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And there were things that they talked about and then things that they were recommending, talking about block grants to the states and expanding Medicare and looking at a whole series of things. They've included things called health savings accounts, talking about them now. Again, when they're saying these will be the things to replace what we've become to know as Obamacare, well, if you don't know what an HSA or health savings account is,
you don't know if you want it or not.
A large part of the jargon becomes meaningless. You don't know whether this is workable or not. And you can't get any honest sense in terms of the way you live your life and the obligations and risks you take every day. And, of course, what you care about and are afraid of when you're dealing with issues like your health care and the health of your family and how you pay for services. All this stuff does matter, but it's so complicated that it makes you even more insecure.
And, you know, we have so many acronyms that fly around, right? So one question that does actually come up fairly often is we will do a review of employer benefits, and they'll say, well, I have an HSA, or I have an FSA, or I'm not really sure what the difference is, or I can put money into something, or sometimes I'll hear them say, I have a health retirement savings account. And so we can talk a little bit tonight about, you know, what actually is a health savings account. Versus what's a flexible spending account, and you know, how can you use these tools and how might they benefit you or not?
And a great many of these programs were in fact created back under the original Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. There are members of both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses that are, you know, talking about which ones they consider to be suitable, which ones are helpful, which ones are better suited to some sort of a revised health care program moving forward. It's all part of the vast library, the vast dictionary of terms and ideas that the president and his staff and his advisors are all trying to work with. And again, the first thing that they have to do is to try to educate the Congress, the Senate and the House, on what these things mean. Because when they go home, like I know this Friday, the legislature, which is the House and the Senate, get to go home for a bit of a vacation. And what do? I mean, in many cases, they don't go home and sit around and play with the grandkids half the time. They usually are going home. They're in there. They have offices within their own constituency. They're meeting with people. They're meeting with local people. And they're doing some of those, what do they call them, the town halls?
Town halls, yep.
Which have become so popular. Some of them do them well and enjoy them. Some of them consider them a nightmare. Others don't do them at all. But they have to understand the terminology themselves. And it doesn't help a congressman or a senator to be able to go home to try to talk to a crowd of people about health care if they're using terminology which may be unique to health care, but it's certainly not unique to the average conversation that Americans have across the dinner table. Mm-hmm. So part of our job and with Get Back to Basics when dealing with issues like politics, especially politics that deal with financial issues that we're wrestling with and that the Congress is wrestling with, and, of course, the decisions that you have to make about money. Last night's program, some of you who did tune in may recall the conversation that we were having was about the lack of preparedness that the baby boomer generations are discovering now that they are already in retirement age or approaching very closely. And the statistics that I was quoting from various sources, including the AARP and other sources, they're staggering. They're things that I just shake my head at. But one that may be more meaningful than anything else is the fact that when I say what the average amount of savings that retirees have who are baby boomers here at the end of 2014, the number may sound large or small, and it may be not meaningful to you at all. But one of the stats that we did talk about that a number of people asked me about today that I talked to, they said, I heard you mention that over 40% of the baby boomers as of the end of last year, 2016, had 40% of them had no income for retirement other than Social Security retirement benefits, that they would be totally 100% dependent upon their Social Security check when they actually come to their retirement age. That's a scary number.
And what's really scary about it is that it's not people who were higher earners probably with larger Social Security benefits, right? So it's probably someone who has a fairly small Social Security benefit to begin with. Otherwise, they would have had the ability to save. Right?
You know, even the average numbers, even though some of you who are listening may know people who will get between $2,000 and $3,000 from their Social Security benefit. And if it's a husband and wife together, both with a solid working history,
they have 4 to 6.
The number could be quite impressive. But, you know, when you find out that the average in this country is really around $1,250 per month,
that's
not a lot of money. But as for today, well, we've got a lot of things happening in Washington, and of course, analysts and traders are watching what's happening down there. We've got the president of China will be coming in on Thursday. He'll be here Thursday and Friday. Probably, of course, the president trying to impress the Chinese president will take him down to Mar-a-Lago as opposed to hosting him at the White House. It's just the way that it is. But the Chinese issue for the United States government, especially as it deals with global trade, is a big deal. The president has, of course, accused the Chinese of money laundering in some cases, but actually money manipulation, monetary currency manipulation, trying to create an advantage by weakening their own currency. By weakening it, making their own manufactured products more competitive in the global markets because those products are priced in the Chinese currencies. And, you know, when the dollar gets strong, I remember a few months back when the president himself called up the Secretary of the Treasury, he hadn't been approved yet, but someone who was a holdover from the Treasury. One of the holdovers from the Obama administration who had agreed to stay on until the new group has won. And the president asked him, a strong dollar, is that good or bad? Now, he wanted to know, from the perspective of the Treasury Department, you know, what is a strong dollar good or is a weak dollar good? Because it seems to be that there are people out there manipulating currency who want weak currencies in their own, whether it's rubles or whether it's euros or whether it's, you know, yuans, which is the Chinese Yuan. They said they're trying to keep. Why do they want weak? Why is that a good thing? Why is a weak yuan good for China? Because I may have to have this discussion. And he's absolutely right. I mean, and in fairness to him, being a developer in the real estate marketplace, he probably doesn't have to deal an awful lot with the issue of currency exchange.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the president's job to know everything about everything from the get-go. That's why you have advisors around you, right? So that is.
But he hears
the
term enough, and you know how the media can be sometimes. You know, if they catch him with something like a gotcha moment, as Sarah Palin used to say,
sure.
Oh, they're all looking for a gotcha moment. You mean to tell me that the president of the United States didn't know the difference between a strong dollar and a weak dollar? Well, we know the difference, but we don't always know how it impacts decisions that we make about money. And we don't always know how it impacts our relationship with other countries. The only thing that so far the White House has said about the upcoming meeting with President Xi Jinping is to talk about the role that they play in influencing North Korea, because they got an absolute one of they, you know, I don't know whether you want to say that he is a surrogate for them, Kim Jong-un, but he's certainly a nut. And they depend, apparently the North Koreans depend upon the Chinese for almost everything in terms of their economy. So you think, so the president's going to try to experiment here and look into just how much influence that the Chinese can employ against North Korea and what they're willing to actually do. Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard here in studio. It is Get Back to Basics Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be right back. And we are back with the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard here in studio. The market itself has had a great year so far as we've moved into closer to the end of the first quarter, though, as we got into the month of March. We started noticing a considerably larger amount of volatility, and a large part of that was you had almost a fanatical optimism over proposed fiscal policies issued by Donald Trump during his campaign and in his conversations after his election. And all of that, based upon the potential for U.S. growth, has fueled what has clearly been a great stock market rally. Now, what's happened in the last, say, the end of the quarter, mostly in March, and now here we're moving into April, is that you're starting to see the market floating into a trading range. the rising protectionist fears based upon, you know, what the government may do related to taxation at the border or taxation of certain types of business overseas, and as well as some concerns over pro-growth agenda potentially falling short of expectations, given the fact that not all members of Congress, even within the Republican Party, are as keen about cooperating, not with just cooperating with the president, but cooperating at the full extent that the president would like them to cooperate to make some of these programs work, especially in, when it comes to the health care program. So anyway, some of this makes some of the analysts, some traders, nervous, and they decide, since they've made so much money over the last 3 or 4 months, that maybe it's a good time to take some money off the table.
So if you're looking to grab some short-term profits, then I guess that's a good opportunity for that.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at your rolling 12-month averages on accounts, I mean, they far outpace targets, right? When you're considering the end of last year, I mean, they far outpace general targets for performance. So I can see where for some people that makes sense, not for long-term investors, but for people who are, you know, more of a trading mind than a long-term investing mind.
Well, the thing that I think investors should take some solace in is that, again, campaign rhetoric and fierce, you know, seemingly unwavering talk on certain policy considerations don't necessarily translate into reality when it comes time to sitting down. Trade, specifically fair U.S. trade, was one of the Trump campaign pillars. He promised the U.S. would renegotiate trade deals that he considers to be unfair. The administration has already moved forward on potential renegotiation of NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, with Mexico and Canada. Now, what investors could perhaps embrace upon that is that as you start to peel back the onions of the, you know, the layers of the onion on NAFTA, you start to realize that NAFTA itself has been a fairly reasonable deal. It hasn't been the terribly unfair trade deal. And as in the campaign, he used to use phrases that people understood, like they're eating our lunch, you know, down there in Mexico.
Terrible trade deals.
You know, terrible deals. When in fact, there's been a tremendous amount of growth. Standard of living in all three countries have increased dramatically since NAFTA was created. The amount of business that goes across the border, back and forth, and new business that was created for the benefit of the United States has gone dramatically through the roof. Yes, it has been genuinely beneficial for Mexico. But, you know, you got to remember where each country starts. If you have a country like Mexico where a standard weekly wage was less than $10.
Yeah, the standard of living isn't even comparable.
You know, it's going to be very difficult. And part of what the NAFTA deal was supposed to do was to create opportunities for Mexicans so that they would have more household income, more disposable household income, and actually become consumers who could eventually at some point be buying American-made products. I mean, that's the premise of a great many of these deals. And we've seen that actually happen with some level of success in countries, including places like Cambodia and Vietnam. But, you know, investors have certainly reverted, looking at, you know, a lot of the rhetoric and everything, to a little more of a cautionary stance than all of the irrational exuberance that comes along with the start of a brand new administration. That in that aspect of the market is going to be around for a while, I would think. There's a lot happening this particular quarter, and the market has already priced in all the good news by most people's standards. Now, we're about to start earnings season here, so over the next few weeks, companies will be announcing.
Well, let's hope earnings support those stock prices.
They do believe. They're expecting actually some positive surprises. They think that companies were actually being relatively conservative with their growth and earnings estimates for the first quarter, and if that's true, then in other words, they've set the bar at a level that may be low enough that a great many of the 500 companies that make up the S&P 500 could easily get over the bar, so to speak.
Set low expectations and people will be satisfied.
Well, you know,
you won't disappoint.
It's hard to say, but I was listening to some of these economists and analysts today talking about, you know, the growth rate of the U.S. economy and how if certain things are successful and if this happens and that happens, we could double the growth rate of the economy or increase dramatically. I'm saying we're a multi-trillion-dollar economy.
It would take an awful lot to move that.
Yeah, we're growing at 1.5 to 2%. If one person I heard say, he says, you know, people don't get it. If we just grow from 2 to 2.5, That's a 25% growth in earnings rate.
In an enormous economy.
In an economy where the PE right now is in the 18 to 20 range, which is higher than the long-term average, but it's not an exorbitantly high PE. If you can get a 25% growth of earnings in the S&P stocks that they track, that's a substantial number. And by the way, with that, we could justify much higher pricing multiples. In other words, we can justify higher prices on Wall Street. Your stock prices, your mutual fund share prices could go up rather substantially. So all of a sudden, where you hear us every night talking about averages in the 5 to 6% range for long-term growth in a diversified portfolio, you could suddenly have in a period of, say, 2 or 3 years, given this environment, maybe you could, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you could literally be looking at growth rate in the 7 to 8 or even 8.5% range.
I was going to say, bump that up to your 7 or 8%.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly do that, and maybe it doesn't become the new normal, but it does state that, well, for this period of time, maybe for this first 4-year term of this administration, that may in fact be enough to get you a better than average overall returns. And again, not 15 or 20% returns for the most part, but you could be looking at 6.5, 7.5% in the market, where 5.5 to 6 would have been considered more normal, growing the economy at roughly 1.5 to 2%. But, you know, that doesn't have to be the case. Now, as we look at the dynamics of the plans that we have, when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking a little bit about what we introduced a few moments ago. Granted, it's medically related, but it's also much...
It's your money.
It's much like the way you save money and spend money on the health care that is so desperately important to you and your families. We're going to be talking about the HSA, healthcare savings accounts, as well as the flexible spending accounts, which is the FSA, and we'll point out that there are differences between the two. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard. We will be right back, so please stick around.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
We welcome you back to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Sowa. This is Get Back to Basics Tuesday with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. And we're chatting right now on this segment about programs that have already been in place. And I'm only bringing it up because it is among the, shall we say, the menu of items that the White House and the Congress and the Senate have on their plate when they start to discuss potential reform or changes in our healthcare system. And given that our healthcare system is 18% of the overall economy, getting this right does, in fact, matter. And of course, for people who have afforded the Affordable Care Act, afforded them the ability to actually get insurance for the first time because they had pre-existing conditions. The elements to whatever this new plan looks like once it is actually put into place are going to be critically important. Some people are going to benefit from the new plan. If we see, obviously, if you're paying outrageous copays or terrible insurance premiums, if those can be brought into a more manageable a part of your annual or monthly cash flow, you'd probably be appreciative of that, especially if you don't have to give up benefits that you've been paying for as part of that. But again, the great fear that the legislature, the Senate and the House has, that they've got to go home and explain to their constituents, you know, that, you know, a large number of you may in fact have the insurance that you now have actually taken away or dramatically reduced.
And, you know, that's something people really don't understand. I mean, how often do you hear people talk about how they love the Affordable Care Act, but they hate Obamacare, right? I mean, how many times have you heard someone, you know, say that? There really is a huge level of ignorance when it comes to insurance and legislation around insurance and what you have and why you have it. But what we're focusing here on today, and it's not just because of there are some restrictions that were placed on health spending accounts and flexible spending accounts, health savings accounts and flexible spending accounts. With the Affordable Care Act, they may be eliminated if it's repealed. But this is really just more because these are tools that are commonly used. They're common employer benefits. And they're commonly used with normal people every day as a way to spend their money smarter when it comes to medical costs and also tools for saving money.
Well, it's interesting, though, that you should say that because I did hear when they were going through the endless debate between the Freedom Caucus and the more moderate Republicans, as well as the White House going back and forth, when the suggestions for things that they would like to see in the new plan
more of HSAs.
Was to see HSAs, which were limited in terms of how much you can use every year, how much you can put away. They actually wanted to, they liked the idea that they wanted them expanded.
So if you think of the philosophy about it, let's talk about what it is to begin with. A health savings account is a tax advantaged account, and all that means is it's deducted from your income before any taxes are paid. So you don't pay your Medicare and Social Security taxes on it. You don't pay income taxes on it. Okay. So it comes out of your paycheck, similarly to the way your 401k contributions come out. It's put into a tax advantaged account specifically for health care expenses. And the limits that you were talking about are the same way. There are limits as to what you can put into a retirement account. They have them for health savings accounts as well. It's $3,400 for an individual, and it's $6,750 for a family. That's what it is this year anyways. And these health savings accounts, anyone can't just have them. Like, I can't have it and you can't have it based on the kind of health insurance we have. These are specifically paired with high deductible health plans. So if you have, I don't know specifically what the deductible minimum is, but say you have a health plan with like a $4,000 individual deductible, you have the ability to, so that means that you're going to have to pay the first $4,000 of costs. Well, where are you going to get this money from? The government has created this health savings account so you can, on a pre-tax basis, put money in here, and there's no taxes paid on it when you take it out.
Well, that's good, but like you said, the idea was that the company may have negotiated with the healthcare provider for a plan that had a fairly low premium base, which was the high, but
right,
because
a higher
it had
deductible
a high,
is a
very
lower
high deductible.
Premium.
But in order to make it possible for the employees that work for the company, as well as the ownership who are part of the plan, to be able to afford that high deductible, they were going to have a combination of payroll withheld from the client, from the employee paycheck, as well
maybe
as
some
possibly a contribution
too.
By the company itself, and the individuals. At least as of this past year, they could put upwards of, like, say, $3,400 in for an individual and, like, $6,750, I think, for a family.
Yes. Yes.
Well, again, is that a lot of money? Is that?
Well, it really depends. I mean, so here's the thing. When an employer goes through, and this is going to be different for small companies versus large companies, because larger companies will very often offer multiple health plans, right? But a smaller company, say like ours, everybody gets the same health plan. We don't have options because we're a small company. So we have to go through and do an evaluation. We want to offer a high-quality health plan to our employees. At the same time, we have to control costs because, you know, when we look at our budget, that as far as our overhead expenses are, other than payroll, our next highest expense is the healthcare. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at that, we say, all right, how can we make this a good quality plan for employees but also affordable for the company's part of things? We'll say, well, does it make more sense for us to be putting contributions into an HSA and pairing it with a lower premium, high deductible plan, or does another plan make sense? So it's going to be different for everybody.
The one thing that the listeners who are focusing on this topic today should keep in mind is the difference between the flexible spending plan and the HSA is that the HSA does, in fact, once it's contributed, it does belong to
you. It belongs to you. It stays with you. It stays with you over time. So if you're funneling money into it but not using it, that's okay. You can build up an account. I've seen accounts with thousands and thousands of dollars in it. I've had, and I think I alluded to this earlier, I've had clients say, I have this retirement health savings account. They were talking about an HSA because when they leave their employer or retire, they take that with them and then they can use it in retirement for qualified health expenses. Those expenses can even include, you know, their long-term care premiums, their co-pays for their Medicare. It can include their services like LASIK eye surgery. It can include glasses. All of those things that your health insurance doesn't pay for or falls short of paying for all of, you can pay for with tax-free money from your HSA. The big thing here is that it's not a use it or lose it kind of thing. You can build it up to really be there as a tax-free source of income to help pay for high medical expenses when you do get to retirement if you don't use it during, you know, your regular life, your working years.
It does remind me a little bit of a 529 in that if you
for medical expenses,
if you don't use the money for what they call qualified expenses, and they have that long list that that there was originally when it was first created, there was like a much like the 529, potentially a 10%
taxes
penalty.
Taxes and 10% penalty.
In taxes and a 10% penalty. But then I understand that it actually went up to 20.
Yeah.
And the suggestion by the Obama administration, not the Obama administration.
That was with the Affordable Care Act. Yeah.
Yeah, as part of that. But the Trump folks have suggested that they like the HSAs and they would really like to bring the penalty back to the original 10%.
So if you're withdrawing it for non-medical purposes, so say you just don't have it, but you really need, I don't know, a car repair and you don't have enough money on the side. If you draw money from here, if you're under 65, you're taxed on it plus a 20% penalty. Again, and that's what you're talking about. It used to be that 10%
penalty. Now, the rule was if, like an IRA, because they use age 65 here, if after age 65 you could draw money out,
just taxes,
it's be taxed as ordinary income, I would imagine, but you have no penalty.
Yep, no penalty on it.
Now, what about do HSAs actually? Are you using pre-tax or after-tax dollars?
Pre-tax dollars.
So you're actually getting a deduction for the contribution that goes into it.
Right.
That's why the entire thing, when it comes out, as opposed to like in a Roth, for example, where you're under a certain age.
After-tax. Yeah. The whole thing is tax-free. So this is.
Or even a 529 I mentioned, your original investment is a return of principal.
After tax dollars.
But the 10%, if there's a penalty because of you didn't use it for qualified purpose,
it's just on the growth.
It would be just on the growth that has occurred inside the plan.
Yes, but this is all pre-tax dollars, just like an FSA is all pre-tax dollars as well.
Well, some people like the idea, thinking, even the discussion we had last night about retirement suggested that well above $200,000to an average
per couple.
And this is not talking about people who end up in a nursing home. We're talking about just out of
this
pocket.
This is just normal
co-pays,
life.
Additional out-of-pocket expenses for medical care after you reach age 65 and, who knows, live to 95. I mean, the way longevity is now.
I'm telling you, people are surprised when they get to 65 and they're doing their Medicare and getting their Medicare policies about how expensive those premiums actually are. When I tell couples, assume that you're going to spend, $600 a month on your premiums, they're shocked.
My way of thinking is if you could contribute $67.50 or whatever the increased amount is over time, if they have an adjustment to that.
I think it will.
Do that as a couple. Get the deduction for it going in. It's invested inside that plan for that thing. And then if you don't end up having to use it to cover deductibles or copays,
don't worry. Eventually, you will.
Yeah, once you retire, you can carry this money onward. You may have had at $67.50 a whack or $7,000 a whack each year. You have an incentive to save it, and it's an asset that will be available to you for a purpose that you think that there's probably you could bet about a dollar to a donut, as my mother always said, that you're going to eventually have to use that money for some medical purpose, even if it's to pay the difference between what your insurance covers, what Medicare covers, and what your Medigap covers.
Whether you want to or not, there'll definitely be a reason in retirement to spend that on medical expenses.
Folks, you're listening to Get Back to Basics. This time, it's the basics of medical savings accounts, these health savings accounts. And it's something that we're letting you know what the rules are today, with the understanding that they may be changed, they could be eliminated, or actually, if you listen to the president, he would like to improve them in some way, shape, or form as part of his new reformed health plan. I guess we'll have to wait and see and pay close attention. This is Money Talk. Donna and I will be right back. We're back with the Money Talk program. We're talking about, a component of what has been part of the Affordable Care Act up to this point, a part of our regular health care system, and what may still remain part of, in some form, any type of reformed health care system under Donald Trump's program.
Yeah, I think it will definitely remain, and like you said, most likely become a more prominent part of everyday healthcare spending. So we talked a little bit about the health savings account. So some of the differences between a health savings account and a flexible spending account are, one is the limits, right? The limits for an HSA are a little bit higher because with a flexible spending account, you can pair it with any health insurance program. So even if you have like a lower deductible plan, you can still have a flexible spending account. So there's no limits there.
So interestingly enough, as they try to describe it, they feel that that most Republicans, for example, who would control the House and the Senate, mm-hmm. can't agree on one thing they do agree on in terms of the existing health care programs is the health savings accounts that Donna was mentioning, the HSAs. They were, like you said, introduced back in 2003. And triple taxed advantage, you get a deduction for the contribution, it grows tax sheltered potentially, and can come out tax free if used for qualified medical expenses. Mm-hmm. Again, you'd have to check with your provider to find out exactly what those are, but they seem to be HSAs among any of these programs, which are monies that are usually taken out of your pay,
mm-hmm.
for example, and put into a plan, oftentimes structured or created by your employer. They're favored by Washington, at least at this moment, and even in the current form that they exist.
Yeah. One thing I do want to mention about flexible spending accounts is unlike your HSA, which can grow and grow and grow, your flexible spending account is a use it or lose it account. So you can put in up to $2,600 in 2017, but if you don't use it by the end of the year, you will most likely lose it. Which I really don't understand the specifics of why. I would have to research that more, but I know that like very often there'll be a grace period, maybe through like March or April, but you use it or lose it. And I remember when the Affordable Care Act first was passed, one of the changes was it was always a use it or lose it account, but you could use it for almost anything health-related in a drugstore, like a CVS or a Walgreens. Now you can only use it for prescription medications. But I remember at the end of the year, I vividly remember going into like a CVS and seeing people loading up on Band-Aids and ibuprofen and children's cold medicine and all of those over-the-counter things because they could use their tax-advantaged account. Their FSA to pay for those things, and they had to use it by the end of the year or to be done. They don't do that anymore. So if you have a prescription for ibuprofen, you can use it to pay for that. If you have a prescription for anything, you can use the money for that, but not for those general over-the-counter drugs like you used to be able to.
Now, most plans have a investment minimum level of about $1,000. Which, you know, they want to be able
to... normally have to be able to...
Yeah, they want to be able to afford the cost of operating and maintaining the plan. Account holders who are over age 55 do, in fact, have a more of a catch-up provision. You can contribute an extra $1,000, which is above the $3,400 level for an HSA.
This is in your health savings account.
Health savings, HSA. $3,400 can go in each year for an individual and up to $6,750 for families. Although every time I've heard these things talked about, they did say... that it's highly likely that Congress will raise the HSA contribution limits, you know, because they do...
Especially if they are going to be looking for more high deductible plans, they kind of have to.
And if you look at the way the Republicans want to try to afford to change the current Obamacare plan, they have to come up with a way... I mean, the biggest target that they have is the cost of health care. Mm-hmm. So the biggest target, the thing that they throw out there, the statistical numbers, are how much insurance premiums on average in certain parts of the country especially, how much they've raised since Affordable Care Act has been created. Within certain states, they've actually doubled what the premiums have actually been. Some states have been minimal. But there are other states.
Is Arizona, that's like the highest.
Yeah,
or something.
Arizona's terribly high.
They have like a 25% increase this next year.
Yeah.
It's really absurd.
And they do have, you know, programs out there that where, you know, the exchanges where that you're supposed to be able to go to assist you in finding the kind of plan that works for you and your family and explain to you how they work and how the benefits work and whether there are tax credits to assist you in paying the bill. The issue of the tax credit is something the Republicans and the White House definitely want to go away because that will the tax liability that creates is hundreds of billions of dollars over time, and they need that money freed up, the money that represents tax breaks freed up in order to deal with what they call tax reform programs, which are the next big program that the government has.
If they can't pass the reform that they want to pass with health care, they can't afford to pass their tax cuts. So this has to get done before they can actually implement the tax reform they want to implement.
Now, one big problem is I like the idea of the HSAs. I think it's a great idea. And if, yes, as a general family, you can afford to take a higher deductible plan because the premiums will be lowered, but you have the ability to put away this money to cover the higher deductibles of the copays, that's great. And that's, I think it's, I understand the logic of that. But here's where the problem comes
in. You have to have the income to do this.
You've got to have the income to do it. I mean, this is put it, I hate to say it, this is not for poor people. This is not for lower income. This is not for people whose income is anywhere near the poverty level. They're not going to be able to put any money away.
No. And that, I think, is getting lost in everything. If you don't have, you can't save for retirement if you can't afford to pay your bills. You can't save for health care, potential health care costs, if you can't afford to just pay your bills. And there are a lot of people, they're not the people that we deal with on a daily basis, but there are a lot of people out there who really are struggling in a way that says, you know, this is all great, but what's the point in getting a tax credit for daycare if I don't pay taxes anyway? I still can't afford daycare, right? So a lot of these plans are great for some people, but they're not helping those that are most struggling.
And the way that the Freedom Caucus types, the ultra conservative Republicans, are looking at the issues, they want to get rid of the one provision of the bill which they really really hate, which is the people who are who have pre-existing conditions. They want to create what they call the risk pool. In other words, all these people would be in a special risk pool, and yet the way in which that they would handle that would be, yes, to try to, because the premiums are going to go through the roof in the risk pool. There's nothing to offset them. So that they say, what do? Go with a lower premium program with an exorbitantly high deductible, and, of course, use the HSA-type programs to cover the difference between your premium and what that deductible would be.
How many of those people with pre-existing conditions do you think aren't able to work or aren't able to work full time because of their health?
And by the way, one thing that doesn't get—I never get noticed, because I know this sounds would sound politically unpopular. But pre-existing condition for an adult is different. How about pre-existing condition for your children? In the case of a family, a child has a heart problem or an issue problem with.
So this is what they grapple.
It's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be a nightmare. And you say, you want to throw children out, having those families live under bridges because they can't afford the child's health care? This is where it becomes a real nightmare. And why, as the president once said, I had no idea how complicated healthcare was.
We just fell down a rabbit hole on that one.
Hey, folks, thanks for joining us. This has been the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program with Donna Sowa Allard and me. I'm Don Sowa. Tune in tomorrow. It's Wednesday. Steve Bovay will be here at 5 with more Money Talk. Have a good night.